budget is a zero-based budget. It is truly the most effective way to plan your spending. This type of budget means you'll need to anticipate your income and assign every single dollar to a category. Don't worry, this really isn't that complicated. It can be as simple as writing down your monthly income at the top of a sheet of paper with every monthly expense written under it. All of your giving and saving, all of your debt payments, hopefully none, all of your utilities, and all the pesky little things that sneak up on us throughout the month. Do your best to plan ahead and spend that income right down the page until you get to zero. When you hit zero, guess what? You're done. You can't keep spending because you don't have any money left. And debt isn't an option anymore, right? Zero-based budgeting eliminates the ambiguity that comes with money, so you can have the confidence you need to know you're taking control of your money instead of your money taking control of you. If you leave any money sitting in your account without assigning it to a category, it will disappear. Every dollar has to be accounted for. A zero-based budget will tell your money what to do. Keep it simple. Give, save, spend. A budget doesn't have to be a complex set of spreadsheets with embedded formulas and pivot tables. All you need to do is organize your budget into three simple areas: give, save, and spend. These three categories are virtually bulletproof. Give. Giving should be at the top of your budget. It's the first thing you do with your money. That throws a lot of people off at first, and I get it. If we're talking about how to make your money go further, it can seem strange to start by giving your money away. But there are some key principles at work here. People who are givers tend to thrive. When you give to others, you become less focused on yourself and more focused on the people and needs around you. You become generous, and generous people tend to have a better quality of life than those who believe life is all about the endless pursuit of more. These people seem to do better in their jobs, finances, marriages, and just about every area of their lives. Giving is a key character trait of people who win with money. It's so important, in fact, that I've made it one of the 7 money habits we're covering in this book. We'll talk about it a lot more later. Save. Your second category should be saving. There may be a few different line items related to savings in your budget. Maybe you're saving for a starter emergency fund of $1,000. Maybe you're saving for a vacation you're going to take in 6 months. Maybe you need to replace a car in a year or two. Brainstorm all the areas where you need to save and decide how much you'll contribute each month. From retirement to Christmas, saving money will help you navigate life without feeling out of control. You might be in a place financially where you have no wiggle room at all. The idea of giving or saving may feel completely out of reach right now. Continue writing out the budget and find places where you can cut so you have the ability to give and save. The dollar amount isn't important at this point. It's more about where you're placing your priorities. But making these first 2 items on your budget will ensure that you do it as soon as you're able. Remember, we're talking about developing healthy money habits to last a lifetime. If you want to develop a good saving habit, you need to practice. Spend. The final category is spending. This is where you're going to list out all of your expenses in life. Of course, there are going to be priorities. Make sure you have 4 basic areas covered before you do anything else. Number 1, food. This is your grocery money. Some people include money for restaurants here too, and that's fine if you want to. The key here, though, especially if money's tight or you're getting out of debt, is that you need good meals to keep you strong and healthy. Of course, that doesn't mean steak and lobster every night, so be reasonable here. Number 2, housing utilities. This can be your rent or mortgage payment, your heating bill, electricity, water, and so on. We're just talking about the necessities here, however. This does not include 900 cable channels. We'll get to that later. Number 3, clothes. This includes money for your clothes and clothes for your children. Again, this should just cover the basics to start. But it's reasonable to expect your children to grow. If you want to add some more expensive pieces to your wardrobe, plan for the basics first, then finish out the rest of your normal monthly expenses. If there's money left, then come back and beef up your clothing category. Number 4, transportation. This will include your gas, insurance and maintenance, or if you don't have a car, money for transit. We call these the 4 walls. Those are your top priorities because you need to have food to eat, a roof over your head, clothes to wear, and transportation to take you where you need to go. Food, shelter, clothes, and transportation can be covered by the bare essentials. If there's extra money in your budget and you want to bump up some of your spending in these categories, consider the wisdom in doing that. Down the road, you'll be able to say yes to these upgrades more often. But if you're buried under car payments, credit card bills, and student loans, now is not the time for luxuries. It's time to stick to the essentials. Once you have those 4 basic areas covered, move down to other areas where you spend money, like insurance, cable, entertainment, and of course, room for miscellaneous expenses. Life is going to happen. You're going to be asked to help throw a friend's wedding shower, or your family will be invited to a birthday party at the last minute, or your kids will take team pictures every soccer season. Things are going to come up that you didn't expect or simply forgot about. So the miscellaneous category is there to catch the slack on those things. If you have debt payments, don't forget those. List those out as well. We covered how to organize your debt snowball earlier in the book. So go back and review that if you're not sure how to budget your debts. This is the part of the budget where you choose how to spend your money. Yes, you choose. For you to live the kind of life you want to live, you have to make choices. Maybe you budget more for groceries because you choose to shop at an organic grocery store. That means you'll have to budget less in another category. Or if you're saving for a new set of golf clubs or a new purse, you'll have to budget to cover those purchases, which means you'll have less money for other things you might want to do. The key here is your ability to choose. Your money can only do what you tell it to do. So be intentional and wise with those choices. That not only gives you control of your money, but your life. For all the stress and dread that's often associated with budgeting, the truth is it's just simply not that complicated. What goes in the budget is totally up to you. You're the boss until it's on the paper. Once you write it down and everyone who has a stake in the plan agrees, then the budget is in charge. Yes, you can tweak it here and there as needed, but if you're married, your spouse has to be involved in the change. And, of course, since this is a zero-based budget, if you increase one spending category, you've got to cut that amount out of another. You can't run your budget negative. Cash is amazing. One of the best tools you can use to keep your budget on track is cash. That's right, cold, hard cash. Did you know stores still accept this? I'm kidding. But my point is, if you tend to overspend in specific areas when using your debit card, nothing will bring your spending back in line faster than using actual cash. Clips and envelopes. The envelope system has been around for decades, and maybe you've heard of it. I've given it my own spin and call it the clip system. I use small binder clips, the kind you can find at an office supply store, to keep my cash in my wallet separated by category. I like this because I can still use my wallet instead of carrying around actual envelopes. The clip system works like this. Let's say you have budgeted $400 for groceries every month. When you get paid, you dedicate a clip to groceries and take $400 cash out of the bank. Then, when you go to the grocery store, you use that cash to pay for groceries. Having cash for a few budget items is great because you always know exactly how much you have left to spend in each category. The categories I personally use with my clip system are groceries, restaurants, personal spending, nails, hair, etc., clothing, and miscellaneous. Winston cashes out his personal spending money and what he wants to spend at Home Depot. That's right, we have a Home Depot line in our monthly budget. Don't miss that, by the way. Winston and I each budget a set amount of cash for personal miscellaneous expenses. I don't care what you call it. Fun money, pocket cash, personal money, whatever. The main thing is that we plan for those miscellaneous things we know we're going to want to do or buy in a given month. Then, when we each get that cash out of the bank, we don't worry about what the other person is doing with it. You need to be unified with your money as a couple, but you don't want to lose your individual identity or talk about every dollar you spend on yourself. Spending less. There's an added benefit to using cash for some categories. You end up spending less. When Winston and I go out for a nice dinner, I get our restaurant cash out. It makes me think twice about ordering an appetizer. It's hard to physically hand over a $10 bill for an extra large bowl of guacamole. And you already know how much I love guacamole. I find this to be true even when I'm shopping. When I hand over $50 in cash for a blouse, there is an exchange that happens. I have to let go of that $50 bill in order to take the item home. The exchange is real, so you feel it. If you get used to carrying cash around, you kind of want to hang on to it. You just don't get that emotional connection to your money if you swipe a card for every purchase. My debit card is always in my wallet. If I buy something with the debit card, I take the item and the card home. But when I use cash, I have to leave something behind. Don't underestimate the emotional punch you get from that. Your own pre-approval. Another reason I love the Clip system is it gives me a tangible permission to spend. When I have money in my restaurant Clip, I can go out to lunch with a friend and not feel guilty about spending that money. Or if I have money in my clothing category, I can go shopping and not question if this money should be used for something else. It's guilt-free spending because it's allocated specifically for shopping. I encourage you to give this a try. The Clip system keeps you accountable. Not only does it allow you to visually see what you can spend, but it also shows you when you have to stop spending. Common budget challenges. Like anything new you start doing, budgeting won't feel normal at first. The most important thing is to keep at it and know that it will get easier with practice. Changing our habits takes time. It doesn't happen immediately. And there are a couple of challenges I've seen people face as they first start their new budgeting lifestyles. Let's take a minute to look at those so you'll be ready for them if they pop up for you. Giving up too soon. A major problem I see when people start doing a budget for the first time is they give up too early. The first month usually ends up being a disaster. They blow the budget in the first few weeks and think, okay, this is never going to work, so I should just give up. Please don't. It will take time, but it will work. Give yourself 3 months for your budget to start working smoothly. The first month will be rough. Expect that. Just go ahead and own it. When Winston and I first started budgeting together, it was hard. And that was after doing a lot of this stuff my whole life. I remember it not working the first month and getting frustrated. But we kept at it, and it started to come together. This can be true for you too. Just keep doing it. Not only are you trying something new for the first time, but you also may have no idea how much money you spend on certain things. Look at your bank account statements and add up each expense category. Get an average of what you spent in each area over the last couple of months. Granted, this may make you want to puke because you will come face to face with your actual spending. Maybe for the first time. Looking at this closely can be scary, but it's necessary. Living on more than you make. The good news here is that your situation may not be as bad as you think. Quite often, people will say, I was terrified to look at all of the bills and write down how much money we actually spend every month. But once I did it, I realized it wasn't as out of reach as I had thought. Thomas Jefferson said, never spend your money before you have it. That simply means live on what you make. A budget isn't going to bring you new money. It will just help you manage the money you have. For some people, when they sit down and write out where their money goes, they see they actually make plenty of money to do everything they want. They realize they've just been sloppy. but others may see there isn't enough money coming in. If that is the case for you, you have an income problem, not a budget problem. The first thing to do is to cut, cut, cut. Don't spend any more money than you have available to spend. If you come up short, then you have to look at some other options. You can't live life spending more than you make. If you've made all the cuts you can and still don't have enough to get any traction, there really is only one other option. You need to make more money. That may mean finding another job, making a career change, working overtime, or taking on an extra job. If you are married and one of you stays home, maybe that person can go back to work or create a way to generate some income from home. Find some way to make that extra income. This may not be a situation you like or enjoy. You may end up doing something you don't necessarily want to do. It might mean being away from the kids for longer than you'd like, or working a job you might not be passionate about. Keep in mind, though, this isn't forever. The situation is temporary, especially if most of your money is going out the door in debt payments that you're paying off. Of course, another trouble spot is failing to communicate and agree with your spouse about the budget. This one is huge. In fact, we're going to spend a whole chapter talking about how to make sure you can keep the happily and happily married when it comes to your money. Electronic tracking. I'm a fan of cash, and I love my Clip system. But I'm also a fan of debit cards. Not credit cards, debit cards. A debit card is 100% okay to use because you're using your money. It's coming directly out of your checking account. You aren't borrowing money from the bank like you are with a credit card. Debit cards. A debit card is absolutely the way to go if you want the convenience of plastic. It doesn't really have the initial sting that comes with using cash, but at least you still know that actual money is being pulled from your bank account every time you use the card. Most people prefer using a debit card over cash because it's easier to handle and you don't have to worry about carrying around a wad of bills. If you're just starting out the budgeting process, try the Clip system for some categories instead of swiping your debit card. If you're a natural spender, cash can be a good friend and accountability partner. Online banking. The days of using a paper check register are essentially gone for most people. Online banking is alive and well, so use it. This gives you great visibility into what's going on with your money. Just be sure to reconcile your checking account against receipts after you use your debit card. Winston checks our checking account pretty much every day. He's one of those high detail people, remember? But we both know what our budget is and what we have to spend. If you don't stay on top of your checking account balance, you could still spend beyond the money in your account. That's called an overdraft. It's possible and much easier to do than you might think. The bank doesn't have much of an incentive to prevent you from overdrafting your account. In fact, they make a ton of money on fees when you overdraft, and they are more than happy to charge you, so be on guard. Also keep in mind that one mistake could trigger a series of overdrafts depending on how different checks and charges hit your account, and you'll owe one big fee for every single overdraft. This one is a killer, so beware. Find an easy way to keep tabs on your checking account balance. Just a little detailed focus and some knowledge of what you have in the account will keep you from going into the red. Also, it's a smart move to keep a little buffer cash in your checking account. An extra $100 will cover the accidental oversight or additional fee you weren't expecting. A zero-based budget absolutely does not mean that you need to run your bank account down to zero, so keep a little padding in there to stay safe. Spend with confidence. Telling your money what to do doesn't have to be complicated or boring. Living within your means is all about being clear and intentional about how you'll use your money. This will help you spend with confidence, knowing you've funded every important category. There won't be this nagging voice in the back of your head questioning every purchase and wondering if you actually have the money to spend. What a relief. Plus, your budget can be as simple as a sheet of paper, or if you'd rather do it online or on your phone, there are some great budgeting tools available, like everydollar.com. Your budget is the path to freedom and fun. Seriously, never forget that a budget gives you permission to spend. This is a critical, essential habit you need to build for living the life you want. Habit 4. Talk about money, even when it's hard. Chapter 8. Marry your money. Let's take a walk down memory lane. Do you remember when social media was first starting out? The first main network in my life was Facebook, back when Facebook was just for college students. I remember receiving my college email address and being so excited that I could set up a Facebook account. As soon as I logged in for the first time, I was hooked. I started scanning through different friend suggestions. One particular guy's profile caught my eye immediately. Winston Cruz. I said to myself, wow, I'd like to meet him. Winston's sister Charlotte and I became friends that year. And no, not because I thought her older brother was good looking. Over the next couple of years, I saw Winston from time to time, and those meetings were always laid back and comfortable. He eventually asked me out, and over time, we fell in love. We started talking about getting married and everything that entailed, including money. Compatibility matters. One of the things I love about healthy dating relationships is that so much gets revealed when the couple starts talking about important things like faith, family, and money. The more time they spend together, the more likely they are to discover each other's strengths, passions, and values. Winston and I had been dating for a little over more than 2 years when my dad invited us to participate together in a conference he designed for small business owners called Entree Leadership. Part of preparing for this conference included taking a formal personality profile assessment called DISC. There are many personality tests out there, but DISC is one of my favorites. DISC identifies 4 quadrants of personality styles: D for dominant, I for influential, S for steady, and C for compliant. D personalities are hard-driving and task-oriented. I personalities are the life of the party, love people, and love being social. S personalities are loyal, calm, rational, and sensitive to people around them. C personalities are process and detail-oriented. When you complete the assessment, you get a detailed document that shows you where you fall in each of the 4 areas. Winston is a high C, while I am a high I. Being around people energizes me, but social events can be draining for him. He loves details and processes, but I have no interest in knowing all the details about every little thing. We're both pretty good at making decisions, but we go about it in very different ways. We balance each other out pretty well. Because we went through this assessment process in our dating relationship, the experience gave us a lot of significant insights into how we are going to interact with each other and what speed bumps we might encounter along the way. Assessments like these shouldn't replace premarital counseling, but they did give us a framework to better understand how and why we are different. That meant we could better learn how to work together, even if we are coming at a situation from different perspectives. Opposites attract. As I travel and meet people all around the country, I see how important it is to understand and acknowledge our different biases, assumptions, and expectations. This is especially true when it comes to money. If you have been married more than 2 minutes, you know that one spouse is probably more of a spender than a saver, and vice versa. One may love to do budgets, while the other likes making money decisions on the fly. One may have a long-term focus, while the other just wants to live in the moment. That's normal. I'm the natural spender in my marriage, and Winston is a natural saver. Now, I say natural, but everyone has the ability to do both. For most people, they just naturally gravitate to one or the other. One preference is simply more dominant than the other. If all you do is spend money, then you have no control, no boundaries, and will end up broke. Bad news for us spenders. But if all you do is save money, then you will miss out on a lot of fun you could be having. That's no good either. While you absolutely need to make saving a habit and a key part of your financial plan, you also need to enjoy all your hard work. There's room in your life for both. Being a natural spender or natural saver is not right or wrong. There is no right way to be. These are simply different bents when it comes to people and how they handle their money. Part of what makes you who you are. As you grow into your understanding of money and create a plan for yourself, you will eventually find a balance between the two. There are two more types we can add to the mix: the planner and the partier. The planner loves doing the budget. This person tends to be more organized, loves details, likes feeling in control, and tends to get stressed out if he or she doesn't have a plan for everything. The partier tends to be more big picture minded and may see budgets as restricting or confining. Generally speaking, as long as partiers have money to take care of the basics and have a little fun, they're happy. Mix and match. Teaching about personal finance is what I do for a living, which includes speaking, writing, and coaching others to develop better money habits. Most people might assume then that I am a planner and Winston is the partier in our relationship, but it's just the opposite. While Winston loves doing the budget, it's still something I have to push myself to do. I know it's crucial for winning with money, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing backflips to work on the budget every month. Thankfully, though, Winston truly enjoys it. It's important to note that savers are not always planners, and spenders are not always partiers. You can be a saver and feel no need for a budget. You can be a spender and plan for everything. We are actually great friends with a couple in which the husband is the spender and the planner, and the wife is the saver and the partier. Obviously, these personality types can come together and succeed in handling money. Potential problem areas. If you're married, money can cause a great deal of stress in your relationship. In fact, a recent study found that arguments about money are by far the top predictor of divorce. It's not children, sex, in-laws, or anything else. It's money, for both men and women. There are a boatload of potential problems when it comes to marriage and money. You may be facing some of these right now. A few of the challenges may be simple to fix, while other problems might take more time and even some outside help. Money fights and money problems are painful. If you and your spouse are struggling to work together as a team, you know how difficult it can be not to agree on money. Perhaps the single most important thing you can do for the sake of your marriage is to work together so that you can be on the same page about your money. If you're not married, but hope to marry someday, start practicing these principles now with someone you trust. Even if you never marry, this information will challenge you to take a good, hard look at all the emotions you have around money and understand how those emotions affect the decisions you make. Separate or joint accounts. Want to know one of the biggest reasons married couples fail to win with money? Separate accounts. If each spouse earns an income, he may have his paycheck going into his account, and she may have her paycheck going into her account. Then, if they do any planning at all, they try to divvy up responsibility. I hear this all the time. Oh, he pays the power bill, and I pay the cable bill. I can't stress enough how huge of a mistake this is. Keeping your account separate is one of the most effective ways to wreck your financial life, and maybe even your marriage. Why would you even take that risk? When you stand in front of God, your family and friends, and the love of your life, and someone says, "I now pronounce you husband and wife, you're married." That declaration means that you are inseparable. You are one. You go from living your own life to being unified with another person. You are now in a lifelong committed relationship, and it's no longer only about you. You're not two business partners coming into a deal. You're one unit. If you believe that in all other areas of life, why would you draw the line at money? You have to be one in every area of your life to have a successful and healthy marriage. While remaining a unique individual, your value systems and goals must line up with one another. Otherwise, you'll end up living two separate lives, and that's when your relationship becomes simply a tax status, not a marriage. In their book, The Complete Marriage Book, Doctors David and Jan Stoops say, "Prior to marriage, many of us had to answer only to ourselves. A major shift occurred when we began our married life. We are now accountable to each other. How do you react when someone limits you? This is where iron sharpens iron, Proverbs 27:17, and the sparks begin to fly. Money is an outward expression of our inward commitment. You either love someone with everything you are, or you don't. You can't have the commitment and trust required to be married for the long haul if you draw the line at money. How you use your money always reveals your priorities. That's because money is never just about money. Money reveals what you truly value in life. Your money not only represents your value system, but it also reveals your goals, fears, and dreams. Being on the same page and unified together in all areas of life is essential, and that absolutely includes your checking account. What's yours and what's mine? The popular "that's yours and this is mine" mindset is destructive in relationships. If you're married, there should be no such thing as my money or your money. It's our money. It doesn't matter who brings in the paycheck or who makes more than the other. When the paycheck hits the bank account, you have to look at it as our money. When you make that shift, you'll start to feel even more unified with your spouse. If you've never had a joint checking account before, it can seem scary. Everything you do with money becomes visible. Suddenly, you're accountable to someone else about what you spend. Someone else is taking a peek inside an area of your life that was once totally private. If you've never been there before, that's a pretty vulnerable place to be. But that vulnerability builds trust, which only improves your relationship over time. One benefit of a single checking account is that it forces you to communicate with one another. It might be a little painful at first, because you may not have had these conversations before. These discussions open the door to see what you and your spouse are doing with money and will encourage you to be accountable to someone else before you make a significant purchase. One warning. It's worth mentioning here that, yes, I am aware there are some extreme situations when a joint checking account may not make sense. Some spouses may have legitimate concerns about trusting their partner on financial matters because of past or present behavior. If your spouse is a gambling addict, for example, he or she probably shouldn't have full access to the family finances. Don't stop using your brain. Common sense prevails. If there is something immoral or irresponsible going on, like drug addiction, marital infidelity, etc., then you need to deal with those realities before joining accounts. That's not really a money problem. That's more of a marriage problem. Get help, rebuild the trust, and then get your money back together as soon as you can. Live and learn. Once you join your accounts, it will become more obvious than ever who is the partier and who is the planner. Winston checks our account all the time. He loves digging into the details and wants to make sure everything is accurate. While I check our account regularly, I don't feel the pressure to look at it every day. I know the budget, I have my cash clip system for some expenses, and I know where my money is going. I simply trust the system. A quick note to planners here. Make sure the partier has all the necessary login information for your checking account. They may not check in as much as you do, but this will increase their sense of ownership in the process. A quick note to the partiers. For the sake of communication and for your knowledge, check in on what's happening in your accounts at least once a month, enough to feel comfortable with the system and to know what's going on. Secret shopping for gifts. One excuse I hear often for separate checking accounts is to keep gift giving a secret. I don't want to combine our accounts because then I can't buy my wife a gift. She'll see how much I spent and where I spent it, and it will ruin the surprise. Let's be real here. This is something that may happen 2 or 3 times a year. Don't put off combining your accounts and missing out on all the benefits for something that only happens at Christmas, on your anniversary, and on birthdays. If you want to buy your spouse a gift, just tell him or her what's going on. When my birthday is coming up, Winston will say, "Hey, I'm going to cash out some money because your birthday is coming up." I know he's going to buy me a gift, so that's no surprise that he needs some money for that purchase. On Winston's last birthday, he wanted a sound bar for our TV in the living room. I printed out a picture of one and taped it to the inside of his birthday card. That way he could pick out the exact one he wanted. If you're shopping online, another option is to use cash to buy a gift card so that your spouse won't see the individual transaction come through the checking account. If you're going to buy something from Amazon, for example, use cash to buy an Amazon gift card at the store. You can even buy a Visa or MasterCard gift card with cash and use it for that online shopping. Just be sure to avoid the ones that try to charge you for an activation fee before you can use the gift card. I know this creates a bit of an inconvenience a couple of times a year, but in the grand scope of your marriage, it's just not that big of a deal. Remember earlier when we talked about trade-offs as something required for creating healthy money habits? Well, this is one of those times. Endure the extra hassle when it comes to surprises and gifts for your spouse. Take advantage of the major benefits of having one account and get creative when you need to. Accounts you shouldn't combine. Both your names should appear on the family checking, savings, and money market accounts. These are easy ones to combine. However, if you run a business on the side, you want to keep your business bank account separate from your personal account. It's fine if both spouses are on the business account. Just don't mix your personal and your business money. That creates a huge mess at tax time. Second, don't combine your retirement accounts. Most banks won't allow you to do this anyway. Roth IRA, 401k, or 403b accounts are all associated with an individual, with the option of listing a spouse as the beneficiary. Separating retirement accounts will allow you to take full advantage of maxing those out individually. But, again, each person needs total visibility on all the retirement accounts. I can't stress enough how important it is to have open, honest, and clear lines of communication around what is going on with every aspect of your financial situation. Of course, do not combine your accounts until you're married. There have been so many horror stories of couples who intended to get married and combined accounts to help pay off each other's bills and debts, only to break up in the end. Until you're married, keep your accounts separate. The day you say, "I do," though, combine your accounts and your debts. In relationships where one person is in debt during the engagement, the other can save up money toward that debt snowball, but they should not write a check for that future spouse's debt until after they say, "I do." Managing the spending wars. Don't fall into a competitive spending mindset, meaning if one person makes a purchase, that justifies a comparable purchase by the other. This idea of equal spending is just a dangerous one. This can quickly become a slippery slope of outspending one another. If each person spends an equal amount as the other, that means you double the cost of every personal purchase. Even worse, you cultivate the idea of keeping score in your marriage, which will eat away at your relationship over time. Competitive spending is grounded in a skewed view of fairness. I have learned that fair is not always equal, and equal is not always fair. This is true in just about every area of life. Each partner has different financial needs at different times. One month, he will need to replace his laptop. Another month, she'll need a new cell phone. You can't get to the end of the year and try to find perfect equality in each person's spending. That's just not how life or money works. Some people also buy into the idea that whoever earns the money has exclusive rights to decide what they can do with it. This usually sounds like, "It's my money. You can't tell me how to spend it, and you shouldn't expect me to give you any of it." Absolutely not. If you earn a big commission check one month, is it okay for you to enjoy some of it? Yes, of course. It's also okay for your spouse to enjoy some of it. And it's even okay for your spouse to enjoy all of it if that's what's appropriate at the time. You can't forget family financial goals during those times either. If a couple is thousands of dollars in debt with no savings, and he wants to go spend his big commission check on new clothes or golf clubs, that just wouldn't be wise. The family has bigger priorities than his golf game. Sorry to all you golfers out there. The wife in that situation shouldn't feel bad about pushing back against that purchase. In fact, I think she has an obligation to throw a flag here, even if she wants her husband to be able to enjoy some new clubs. You can't justify or enable irresponsible spending habits because you feel like someone deserves it. Teamwork through budgeting. You can prevent any of the situations above by doing a budget together. You're setting priorities and giving yourselves permission to spend in specific ways that lead to your goal. The budget you do together will keep your lives and dreams in a healthy balance with one another. Doing a budget together also kills the mindset that says, I make more so I can spend more. This is an unhealthy, not to mention destructive, way of looking at your money. Say goodbye to the I deserve it attitude at the wedding ceremony. A great way to think about this is to view all income as budgeted income. Nothing is off the table. Bonuses, tax refunds, and side project money from both spouses all flow into one big pile of cash that sits at the top of your budget, ready to be spent on paper first. That way, it's all going to be accounted for in the budget you will do together. The bottom line is this. Someone is always going to make more in any marriage. Avoid focusing on your income and your spouse's income as separate entities. The challenge is to get rid of the "this is my income" mentality and have a unified mindset. The money that comes into your home has to be seen as one combined income. Looking at money this way will cause an emotional shift in your thinking that will impact your money habits and your marriage in a positive and powerful way. Marriage is built on communication. Language shapes how we view other people and the world around us. That's why I've pushed so hard on your thinking, attitude, and the conversations you're having with your spouse. If you're budgeting together, then you're talking about money together. I can tell you from personal experience that it's worth pressing through those conversations, even if it takes a lot of energy and it isn't easy. Winston and I still hit the occasional speed bump when it comes to dealing with our money. We struggle with the same things every married couple struggles with. Once in a while, we need to hit reset on some things. That makes up the essence of a healthy marriage. A lifetime of learning how to work together, especially as circumstances change. We found that our marriage is stronger and our life together is sweeter because we believe and behave in ways that make us one. We were taught this long before we were married. We were both lucky to have had parents who modeled this for us growing up. In our families of origin, no matter who brought in the paycheck, there was always an our money approach to financial matters. When Winston and I talk about our income, I don't even think about what I make versus what he makes. I only care about what we make. We're a team, and the team is going to win together. We didn't start talking about money by accident. You won't either. You have to be intentional and deliberate when it comes to talking about money, even when it's hard. Chapter 9, Important Conversations. I've mentioned how much I love New York City. I go there as often as I can, usually for work. Everything about the city is great. The food, the shows, and of course, the shopping. I feel like every time I'm there, the Holy Spirit whispers to me, "You should be living here." Ironically, my husband says he hears the same thing when he is in a duck blind. So, Nashville it is. Now, you need to understand something. Winston and I have had a line item in our budget for clothes from day one. It's something I love to spend money on, so we plan for it. I happened to be shopping one afternoon on a recent trip to New York City. I couldn't believe how many great sales there were. You probably know where this is going. Yep, I busted the budget. Now, normally, I would text Winston to let him know I was buying some clothes. This helps me stay accountable. This particular time, though, for whatever reason, I didn't. I ended up spending about $250 more than I meant to. As the day passed, the reality of how much I spent was setting in. I couldn't stand it anymore. I texted Winston about my spending. He assured me it was no big deal. We had the extra money. But it was a big deal for me because I felt like I was carrying a big secret around with me, and I didn't like how that felt. That's when it hit me how much I rely on quality communication about money with my husband. When it was missing, even for just one shopping trip on a New York City afternoon, I felt disconnected from my marriage. That may sound dramatic, but it's true. I hate feeling like Winston and I are on different pages. And that's why we talk about money. You have to talk about money with your spouse if you want to get on the same page. If you don't, you're setting yourself up for some relationship straining situations. Financial infidelity. When I realized my oversight that day, I told Winston right away. I had to. I was driving myself crazy. Some couples, though, hold on to those secrets for far too long. One of the most painful problems I see with married couples is financial infidelity. This happens when one spouse hides purchases, accounts, or money from their partner. This can present itself in ways like a secret credit card, a hidden bank account just in case the marriage goes south, or chronic issues like gambling. This type of behavior can devastate a marriage. The pain and feelings of betrayal are so severe that some people think it's comparable to sexual infidelity because of all the lying, mistrust, sneaking around, and dishonesty that's needed for that kind of thing to happen. Anytime you purposefully hide something money-related from your spouse, that's financial infidelity. Infidelity versus irresponsibility. Let's not get too crazy here, however. There is a difference between infidelity and irresponsibility. A woman once told me, "My husband was financially unfaithful to me. He went out to lunch 6 times last month and didn't tell me about it." In that case, I'd give him the benefit of the doubt. He probably simply forgot to mention those lunches to his wife. I wouldn't consider that to be infidelity. Sloppy? Sure. Forgetful? No doubt. But infidelity? Not really. If, on the other hand, he spent hundreds of dollars taking big groups of people out and purposely hid that information from her, then yes, that might be financial infidelity. But grabbing a burger with coworkers and not mentioning it would not qualify. How do you know if you're skirting the line between irresponsibility and infidelity? I think it's a matter of intention. If there's ever a point when you feel the need to hide a purchase because of how you think your spouse will react, or if you simply don't want your spouse to know about something you bought, then you're in the danger zone. Something's going on with you or in your marriage that you need to dig into. Have you spent money you agreed you wouldn't spend? Then you have to own up to that mistake and tell your spouse right away. If talking about money isn't already a habit in your marriage, it's time to sit down together and get the communication started. The more you avoid the money discussion, the more likely it is to begin to splinter your trust and confidence in each other. Preventing relationship damage. True financial infidelity will cause significant damage to your marriage. If you're there right now, choose to take the difficult but necessary steps to bring it out into the open. Get some competent help. Bring in a third party like a marriage counselor, a pastor, or someone else you both trust. Like I said before, if it's taken to extremes, financial infidelity can feel like an affair, so you need to treat it seriously. At that point, it becomes more of a marriage problem than a money problem, and you can't budget your way out of a broken marriage. If you're the one committing financial infidelity, ask yourself, why do I feel the need to hide this? What is the motivation behind wanting to sneak around? Face that unhealthy attitude and come clean. This will slowly lead to better communication on priorities you both agree upon. In previous chapters, we talked a lot about budgeting together and having joint bank accounts. We talked about why each partner needs full visibility and access into everything, and we've covered why it's important for spouses to approach their finances as a team. If you're doing all of that and taking it seriously, financial infidelity is much less likely to happen. From a relational standpoint, I found that couples who work together on their money are generally closer, so the trust factor is much higher. And from a practical standpoint, it's just hard to hide purchases from a spouse who is regularly checking the budget and looking at the bank account online. You've built in safeguards to help protect against one spouse going rogue with the money. Now, you may be reading this and know for certain that something is going on with your spouse. Maybe you've become convinced of some serious financial infidelity and you aren't sure what to do. This may feel like you're trying to hold back a tidal wave of uncertainty and anxiety. If you're dealing with a well-established pattern of behavior, be smart about it. Do what you need to do to protect your health and finances. In the face of extraordinary financial misbehavior, you may have to temporarily go back to separate checking accounts. We talked about some reasons for doing this in the last chapter. This is a time when it would be necessary to protect yourself, so don't feel bad about doing it. This doesn't close the door forever, though. With effort and focus, you and your spouse can get back on track, work through it, and get past it for good. Leave nothing off the table. Love puts no limits on topics for conversation. That includes money. While financial infidelity can be devastating, you don't have to let it get that far. The key to getting on the same page is to budget together. It may seem like a simple answer, but it is the answer to most money problems in marriage. Find a time and a place to do this. Make sure you both are present. This can be at a restaurant, your kitchen table, or on the back porch. Winston and I usually do our monthly budget while we relax on the couch together. Find a place and a time before the next month begins to sit down and make it your budget night. Remove any distractions. Turn off the TV. Make sure the kids won't interrupt you. If necessary, go out on a budget date and make talking about money a little more fun. Whatever you have to do to make this time appealing to you both, do it. Listen, don't tell. When two people bring their own histories, views, and experiences into marriage, it's easy to understand why so many couples argue about money all the time. In his book, The Meaning of Money in Marriage, David Augsburger said, "The handling of finances is one of the major emotional battlegrounds of any marriage. Lack of finances is seldom the issue. The root problem seems to be an unrealistic and immature view of money. The only real cure for this potential landmine is open and honest communication." Keep in mind that you both have an opinion on when it comes to money matters in the relationship. You are not the only one with this perspective on the issues. That can be easy to forget. That's why it's important to listen first and speak later. Actively listen to what your spouse has to say. Paraphrase his or her concerns in your own words. Because money usually carries an emotional response with it, you'll discover what's important and what creates stress for your spouse. If you ever feel a sense of hesitation or fear going into a budget conversation, get that out on the table too. Oftentimes, this mild dread is perfectly normal when you do new things. Don't let that stop you. Push through it. While we should never let feelings stop us from talking about money, we should be aware of how those filters influence our reactions to money conversations. She might be nervous or scared. He might have his pride knocked down. Her security could be rattled. His self-esteem could be low. Be aware of how sensitive this process can be to your spouse. Remember, every relationship has a planner and a partier. Both have a role to play in how you decide to use money. The planner is likely going to love this discussion because it will be a time to dig down into the details. The partier is likely to show a bit more resistance. If you are the planner, here's a word of caution. Don't approach the partier, hand him or her the budget, and say, "Here's the budget. You don't need to look over it. It's done and it's correct." Be prepared to listen to the partier and their thoughts about how money in the budget should be spent. While you may be the more organized of the two of you, you still need to get the partier's input. Now, if you are the partier like I am, you have to bring two things to the budget meeting: your opinion, and maturity. Leave statements like, "I want to spend half of our money on clothes," at the door. Or worse, don't say, "Sure, that looks fine." Whatever you want to do, speak up and offer your opinion to the conversation. The budget needs to be visual so you both can see it. Write it down or use a budgeting app like EveryDollar.com. This needs to be done before the month begins. And you need a new budget every month, even if most numbers are similar month to month. There are many benefits when you create a budget together. When you're agreeing on where your money's going, it will unify the two of you in ways you may not have experienced before. There will be a sense of harmony where there used to be tension. You get to agree on where you're going in life together and on where your dreams will take you. Over time, you may find that talking about money is more valuable than money itself. Dream together. Winston and I often have dinners together when we just talk about what we want life to be like in the future. We've done this from the beginning of our marriage. Shortly before one of those conversations early in our marriage, Winston was just getting into real estate. He started dreaming about the day we could buy a small property with cash and rent it out. We talked about going to Disney once we had kids. We even imagined what we'd like retirement to look like for the both of us. As we talked, the conversation kept building on itself. After about an hour of talking about all the things we wanted to do and the places we wanted to go, we suddenly snapped back to reality. We wondered if we are being a little shallow talking about all of this for so long, but then it struck us. No, we weren't being superficial. We were dreaming, and we were doing it together. That conversation was huge for us as we started our life together. Have talks like this with your spouse. Just dream. Go on a date and have fun thinking about your future together. It's amazing how much joy there is in working together toward the same goal in life. These types of conversations can bring focus, purpose,